Hi, this is Jan Miyasaki, the host of the Wednesday 8 o'clock Buzz. Thank you for tuning into WORT. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a donation at wortfm.org/donate. And with me on the phone is Sophia Guerra. Sophia Guerra is Program Assistant for the Nuclear Disarmament and Pentagon Spending Project at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. So last month, the Pentagon released their annual unfunded priorities list, the list known as UPLs, otherwise known as its annual wish lists, for additional weapons and projects that the president didn't ask for. So currently, Congress mandates the Pentagon to submit UPLs each year, and Guerra describes this as offering a backdoor to spending to boost the already exorbitant military spending. So I wanted to talk with her about this and about the bipartisan streamline the Pentagon Budget Spending Act that would repeal this wish list funding. Good morning, Sophia. Guerra, it's great to have you on with me this morning.
Good morning. Thanks. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so, you know, for folks who, so you're at the Friends Committee on National Legislation working on the, in the nuclear disarmament and Pentagon spending. Can you just kind of talk about what you focus your work on? And then I want to talk about your post at the website on the unfunded priorities list.
Sure. And for your listeners who may not be aware, the Friends Committee on National Legislation is an 80-plus-year-old nonpartisan nonprofit run by Quakers. And so nuclear weapons disarmament is really a legacy issue for us. I think we've seen a lot of intersections between the nuclear disarmament work and efforts to reduce the Pentagon budget, especially since the detente of the Cold War, which is related to the UPL topic today. I think the Pentagon budget has always been a very fraught place of national security policy making. And since the budget is so large and the military budget is so large and so much of it has been unaccounted for, it's really surprisingly easy to get smaller programs greenlit that have a lot of implications for nuclear weapons. So, for example, the Friends Committee has in the past worked on canceling the submarine-launched cruise missile, which was initially, and I believe it's still planned to be a lower-yield, quote-unquote, nuclear warhead, which is supposed to be usable in a smaller battlefield. So we do work on resolutions that have to do with kind of expressing the sense of Congress to see through to the value of arms control in the future, to introduce a follow-on to the New START Treaty once it expires in 2026, as well as to make sure that we are keeping doors open for diplomacy with China and Russia on arms control and other issues. And we see that as really important to making sure that we have a national security policy that is predicated on the well-being of our citizens and the citizens around the world who could rightfully benefit from a lot of these ill-spent military dollars.
You know, what I appreciated about your piece on UPLs was there was a link to an article about what was in the actual budget request by the president. And, you know, I know about these things, but when I saw it laid out and I saw it linked to each one, it was kind of mind-blowing, honestly, the destructive power of what was being asked for in the budget. So I appreciated that link. I mean, just on that piece itself, it was pretty disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. It's not every day, and certainly the average person doesn't get to sift through the president's budget request, and much less the Pentagon budget itself. Again, that's about two-thirds of it, which has been unaccounted for, and we're currently on the seventh audit that I believe the Pentagon has failed to pass in several years. So this is a really... this is an issue as we creep to $1 trillion military budget. We're right under that, the $900 billion threshold. and for a reason. As we get closer to that, I think it's more and more important that we try to sift through the kind of banal parts of the budget.
Yes, and this is what we're talking about. Is separate from the piece of legislation that was passed over the weekend and today, correct?
Yes, that's correct. These wish lists are a extra budgetary mechanism that are in addition to, frankly, many other mechanisms that the military is able to use to justify more funding simply in the name of national security. And of course, the tough thing there is that you can kind of justify a lot in the name of national security, regardless of whether that actually meets our national security needs. And it gets even tougher when you consider the fact that most of the unfunded priorities list items are classified and have been historically. This year, especially, where we have, the newer lists from the Space Force, from Cyber Command, from Space Command as well, that's billions of extra dollars that especially the Space Command list is 76% of it, or no, 84% of it, excuse me, is classified. So there are multiple layers that are obscuring proper oversight here. Yes. And it's already outside of the formal budget process, which is already under high scrutiny.
So there's what the president asked for, then this other list, and it's really a misnomer to call it unfunded priorities list. How does it work?
Yeah, so to kind of bring you back to the onset of these lists, they emerged in the late 1980s. They were more of a practice than a requirement. They were basically an attempt by lower level military leaders, lower level mainly meaning that they're not political appointees in the Department of Defense. They were concerned that they weren't going to meet their readiness needs towards the end of the Cold War. And so sometimes if you look through the conference reports from the National Defense Authorization process back then, you'll see some items denoted in italicized notes that they are indeed unfunded requirements. And the military continues to refer to these as unfunded requirements. But if you see even the Navy's list for this year, for fiscal year 2025, they emphasize that these lists are not to be prioritized or over what is in the actual president's budget request. They actually say in this list that they're urging Congress to not make any changes to what they authorize as the budget request, because if you're unfamiliar with the authorization process, the president submits that request, and then the Armed Services Committees receive those requests, and they also receive the unfunded priorities list 10 days after that. And as they are considering all this is all just for the authorization bill that just says, hey, we are going to fund XYZ programs. After that, though, there's an extra appropriations process, which is why this is such a high scrutiny process. But basically, that's kind of the environment we're working in here.
It's a
holdover from the end of the Cold War.
And it's misleading to call it unfunded. It just means that it's not in the president's budget, and that historically, a good piece of the UPL list goes on to be funded. And now I just want to make sure Sophia Garrett didn't say this. I saw this quote from another person from the Center for Responsible Statecraft, and he called it a method for the arms lobby to supersize the Pentagon budget. a critical statement there. So this year, though, there is a bipartisan statement to not fund the wish list, right?
Indeed, there is.
Yep.
Yes, that's HR 4740. It's led by Representative Jayapal and Davidson, as well as Senators Warren and Braun on the Senate side. And this basically would repeal the mandate for these wish lists, because ever since 2016, at the onset of the Trump administration, and there's not a lot of documentation for this, but in 2016, you'll see that during the NDAA process, and so that'll come up again and again, there's a lot of kind of backdoor dynamics there that are not recorded by Congress. That dynamic resulted in that annual mandate where even if you don't have anything to request, so that'll be Transportation Command, this year that was Cyber Command, I believe, you still have to send that letter, which is, we've heard from staff, from armed services staff, does constitute a bureaucratic burden.
And so tell us more about the legislation. And when you say bipartisan, that means that there is both Republican and Democratic support, sort of the centrist Republicans, right?
Yes, right now they've been working with a Noah's Ark strategy, and that's been working to kind of get this very similar to the War Powers Coalition going. Right now it's basically 50-50 bipartisan, and it's also a follow-up effort on Representative Jayapal's amendment last year to the appropriations bill, which would have defunded the lists entirely. And we had around 30 Republicans vote in favor of that amendment. And that amendment, just by nature of being in the appropriations process rather than the authorization process, which I know this can get a little technical here, it went way farther, and thus we were able to kind of whip those Republicans into shape and get them to hop on this one as well. So we're really doing a concerted drive with our advocacy teams and our coalition partners, because we have many watchdog organizations in the space, to mobilize their networks to lobby those members of Congress. And those are folks like Rhett Mooney from West Virginia, for example, who recently signed on as a co-sponsor officially, although he voted in favor of the Rep. Jayapal amendment to the appropriations process last year. So we're finally seeing folks kind of shed their fear of spending too much political capital to repeal this mandate, because really this is just repealing the mandate rather than going for getting rid of it entirely.
So, yeah, it is. Now I'm just thinking about how the need to reform the whole Pentagon budgeting process altogether, because everything is so, it's not very transparent. There's all this secret stuff going on. But what we do know is that there's a $895.2 billion request by the president, and then an additional $25.8 billion based upon these UPL lists, that at least this one step is to just rescind the mandate for it. Don't know how that will actually affect the backdoor spending. This year was, you write that this year's UPLs are particularly excessive. Can you just talk more about you know, what a big hole this is to plug?
Yeah, so this year, like I said, a large amount of this year's lists are classified. And then I will say that something to point out is that U.S. Strategic Command did not submit at least a publicly accessible list. It can be sometimes difficult to figure out whether, if you can't find a list, if they simply submitted $0 as a request, or if that entire list is classified. And given the cost overruns incurred by the modernization program for the land-based leg of the nuclear triad, this U.S. Strategic Command did not request anything. However, there's also the National Nuclear Security Administration that gets to submit a list. There's also the Missile Defense Agency that gets to submit a list. And both of those also have to do with nuclear weapons. So for things like nuclear weapons, you still have a lot of mechanisms to get the funding you need, which is despite already a lot of industrial restraints there. And that's just the issue of nuclear weapons. It's not even talking about the air defense's capabilities included in Central Command's lists. And it's not including the many classified items in the Indo-Pacific Command's list. And the problem with that is, as you mentioned, it's not just the lack of oversight or the lack of transparency. But with this lack of transparency, you also see that you're going to find some national security implications. When you can make lists like these, it's often driven by parochial interests more than anything. So if, let's say, you're an Air Force commander in charge of the F-35 program, which has incurred a lot of cost overruns and has been included in several unfunded priorities lists or wish lists in the past, and called the Ferrari of aircraft when it was commissioned. And it was, I believe it was called the Ferrari of aircraft by the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest ranking military officer in the nation. So it's really easy to sneak in programs that really have marginal benefit for national security, and also are a very blatant way for contractors to fit in very high expense acquisitions when they were when the initial request was much simpler and much more cost effective. So these lists kind of make it difficult for the military to be financially, fiscally responsible. Because, and here's another example, the Army year after year has zeroed from the presidential budget request this tank called the M1 Abrams tank, just because they didn't think it was really that important. But Congress, time and time again, had included funding for that tank in the appropriations process, which then also led to it being included on several UPLs, several wish lists, and being very easily included in the authorization process henceforth. Yes. So there's a lot of different ways in these lists for programs that are really questionable for national security to be funded. And when you have that, you are dealing already with a kind of tightrope. If you listen to Armed Services Committee hearings, every military leader will tell you that we need X, Y, or Z because we need to deter Chinese invasion of Taiwan. But obviously, some things might achieve that goal better than others. But when you look at the list, sometimes you might greenlight a program that actually raises the risk of escalation in that exact area. So there's a lot of... Not only are these lists difficult to find, and that they are not just easily accessible to the public, they're not in one place, they're not often distributed even among a lot of congressional staff. There's also just a lot of kind of weeds to spill through when you're looking at the lists themselves, even if you do get them. And then you of course may get caught up in arguing with an armed services member about, you know, the nitty gritty of military planning, when really the takeaway here is that when there are so many people who are just one public health crisis away from a drastically different financial situation, it just doesn't make sense that the Pentagon can get funding for whatever it desires every year.
$25.8 billion on the a whopping, you say $25.8 billion on the UPL's list that, you know, often go, as you say, to things that, well, I'll say, are outdated, don't work, will never work, and are something of a sweetheart deal with the arms lobby. It's just, you know what it is. The streamlining, the Pentagon budget Act is where in the process?
Yeah, so right now it is a standalone bill, H.R. 4740, and we are still waiting for Senate introduction, getting there soon, especially when we onboard more co-sponsors. We have waiting in the wings. We're expecting that it may turn into an NDAA amendment, but that doesn't really change anything because our main ask would be to just tell your representative to either communicate their support on the Senate side or sign on to the standalone bill. And then that's the metric that these bill leads will use moving forward with the NDAA amendment. And hopefully with enough co-sponsors, because there's typically a number that you aim for, that will bring it to markup on the Armed Services Committee. So that's where we are now. The NDAA process is already kind of underway and moving a lot more quickly than normal. So that's why we point people to that bill to make things simpler.
Yes.
Because the NDAA process and the budget process has never been simple.
And this would just revoke the mandate. At least we don't have to grease the process for everyone. So I guess is how I'm hearing you. But Sophia Guerra, I appreciate that you're responsible for, you know, doing the deep dive on stuff like this and then letting us know about it. So, folks, I want to direct you to the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a website for all kinds of important information. Sophia Guerra, thank you for joining me this morning. It was great to meet you and talk with you.
Thank you, Jan. It was nice to meet you, too.